counsel. Sorry for the momentary delay. Ready to proceed?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Brian Sullivan, Corbin Sullivan, for the appellant, James & Jackson, LLC. It's my pleasure to introduce to the court Mr. Michael Collins from the Bickel & Brewer firm, Dallas, Texas, who will be presenting the argument.
Welcome to the court.
May you proceed, Your Honor?
Yes.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. As Mr. Sullivan said, my name is Michael Collins. I'm with the law firm of Bickel & Brewer in Dallas, Texas. May it please the court. I'd like to state just initially on behalf of my client, and I'm sure Mr. Pleshy's client, we greatly appreciate the court taking the time to expedite this matter. It's an important matter to us. We also think it's an important matter to the legal community in general, and we greatly appreciate, we know how busy the court is. Thank you very much. We are here on two issues. The first issue is who decides whether a claim should be arbitrated, the arbitrator or a court? Two, if the court is allowed to decide whether claims need to be arbitrated, whether the claims in this proceeding should have been arbitrated. This action was commenced, I'll give a very brief procedural background, was commenced on November 11, 2005. By Willie Gary LLC against my client, James & Jackson LLC, two limited liability companies that are owners of a Delaware limited liability company that operates a cable TV station that focuses on the black community, age groups 25 to 54, with family programming. They have a written operating agreement dated in December of 1999. That written operating agreement has an arbitration clause at section 12.12. Plaintiff Willie Gary LLC commenced this action asking for the court, the Chancery Court, to order our client to agree to a dilution of its interest in NBC. They asked for injunctive relief and specific performance. On November 16th, we filed a notice of arbitration saying that claim should be arbitrated. They then amended to add another breach of contract claim, but only seeking injunctive specific performance, and then they sought dissolution. We believe all three claims should be arbitrated. Vice Chancellor Strine, in a very well-reasoned decision that we don't necessarily agree with, but very well-reasoned decision, disagreed with.
Could I ask you, with respect to dissolution, you're saying that that should be arbitrated as well?
Yes.
Even though the agreement talks about a judicial determination of dissolution?
Yes, that is one of the grounds for dissolution. Yes, it is. And we believe that's not inconsistent with seeking arbitration of that claim. Number one, they ask for several grounds for dissolution. One, they say it should be judicially dissolved. But two, they also say, as majority owner, we've already agreed to dissolve it and made that choice. So it's just not the judicial dissolution. But in the
okay, I'm having trouble. Do you agree that where it part of your agreement says judicial dissolution? That would be referring to a court and not an arbitrator, right?
No, we think that could be referring to arbitration under the broad arbitration clause of our agreement. As in the Terex decision by another chancellor of the Chancery Court, he said that's not inconsistent. What you could do is have the underlying facts determined in the arbitration, and you can have it confirmed in a court, for example, the Chancery Court, but it's referring to judicial dissolution is not inconsistent with arbitration at all, especially when there's a broad arbitration clause. In the Terex decision, the vice chancellor found that there was a similar judicial intervention. It was worded a little bit differently. But he said that's not inconsistent. That decree of judicial dissolution is not inconsistent with arbitrating that claim. The arbitrator will determine the facts, the law, make an award, and then that award can be taken to the court and confirmed or enforced, which is usually done in arbitration. The arbitrator will make his decision, and the parties often come to the court to confirm it, to reverse it, to remand it. And in this circumstance, one of the things you would do to enforce it is to seek a judicial decree of dissolution. It would be very simple in the court. It wouldn't determine the facts and law again. It would just take the arbitration award. If there are no grounds to set it aside, it'll be confirmed and enforced.
Let's assume for a moment that one of the things that we're charged with doing in cases of this kind is to determine what the parties intended and then look at the policy of the state and how it applies to what the parties intended to see if the agreement's enforceable the way in which they intended it. Did Vice Chancellor Strine's opinion put us in the minority view on whether the disputes between the parties here are subject to arbitration or subject only to court action?
As far as the first question of who should decide that, we think he's in the clear minority. As far as whether these claims should be arbitrated, assuming he can make that decision, we still believe he's in the minority. We've cited cases from Delaware. We've cited decisions from other courts in the country saying that dissolution should be arbitrated under a broad arbitration clause. But as to the first issue of who should decide whether these claims should be arbitrated, he's in the clear minority.
If the agreement suggests that on the issue of dissolution alone, there might be two ways to go about it, that it could be subject to arbitration, or because dissolution is governed by statute and is a unique form of termination of an agreement, if the parties have left themselves with alternatives, why would we interfere and say you must arbitrate, as opposed to using the option of going directly to Chancery for the dissolution remedy alone?
Right. Well, I say we disagree that it was an option here, either or, with respect to dissolution or the other claims too. But
well, let's explore why it might not be. Yeah, it seems logical, at least to me, that disputes that arise between parties are broadly subject to arbitration when they contemplate the business continuing on. That's the quickest, the most efficient way of getting it resolved so the business can continue on. But when the parties or one party's option is to dissolve the business altogether, why doesn't it make sense just to have it go to court, process through the statutory procedure that's available in Delaware?
It certainly does make sense, and that's why it's used in a lot of proceedings. But with the arbitration clause, again, goes to what did the parties intend? Did they intend to arbitrate that? We, absent an arbitration clause, the Delaware courts are experts in dissolution and other corporate matters. We don't dispute that.
Well, Vice Chancellor Strine seemed to think, at least as I read it, that he's operating under the Federal Act, that the United States Supreme Court's language is important in interpreting arbitration under the Federal Act, and that the evidence was not clear that the parties actually intended the issues before him to be subject to arbitration, because all they did was import language from the American Arbitration Association rules, and that those rules weren't so clear that he could determine they manifested the intent to subject these disputes to arbitration. Where did he get that wrong?
Okay. On that question of who should decide whether it should be arbitrated, we agree there's no presumption in favor of arbitration. On whether these claims should be arbitrated, there is a presumption there. So stepping back to that first issue of who should decide, the reason he got it wrong is we believe that this agreement, Section 1212, made it clear and unmistakable the party's intent that these claims, whether these claims should be arbitrated, is an issue for an arbitrator. They did that by incorporating the AAA rules.
Now, he interpreted 12.12 to be at least a separate section that made that incorporation of the AAA rules ambiguous as to the party's intent by looking at the option of seeking injunctive relief or specific performance, which he assumed would come from the court. Do arbitrators have the power under the rules that were incorporated into this agreement to specifically enforce the terms of an agreement or grant injunctive relief?
Yes, there's a specific rule, and I would have to look it up for you, on injunctive relief, and generally a arbitrator can grant specific performance. But yes, they are specifically empowered in the AAA rules to grant injunctive relief.
Well, why is his interpretation of 12.12 or 12.12, however you want to phrase it, incorrect? Because he seemed to use that language to say this is an example of why it's not so clear and unmistakable that the parties intended to subject these disputes to arbitration.
Okay. Because we start off the clause. We have a broad arbitration clause. You'll arbitrate everything arising out of or related to this agreement. And you will arbitrate it under the AAA rules. Then from there, they have two exceptions to what you have to do if you're seeking injunctive relief. But again, someone has to decide whether this is within the clause itself. Did they agree to arbitrate these particular claims are presented to the court.
Well, and it seems that Justice Breyer addressed that in the Howsam case. He describes this as a gateway type of dispute. And there he says whether an arbitration clause in a concededly binding contract applies to a particular type of controversy is for the court. So putting aside what the Vice Chancellor did in the first half of his opinion, when he gets to the second half, he says, in any event, I conclude that this is a matter that the court could decide, that is, if there's going to be a dissolution. So he's saying this particular controversy was carved out as something that wouldn't be arbitrated. Why isn't that correct?
Okay. As far as a dissolution, it's not injunctive relief or specific performance. As far as his reading of whether he decides whether these claims should be arbitrated, the Howsam Court, we don't believe, decided the issue of who decides whether a claim should be arbitrated. It dealt with who should decide whether a claim was time barred, which is not an issue of arbitrability in the first instance. What Vice Chancellor Strine did is said, is I disagree with all those federal cases saying that if you incorporate the rules, merely by incorporating the rules, you've demonstrated your clear and unmistakable intent that the arbitrator will decide whether these claims should be heard by the arbitrator or by the court.
Well, another way to look at what he said, though, is that this opinion is internally inconsistent, and even I mean, that your agreement is internally inconsistent, and that even if you agree that most things would be subject to arbitration and reference to the rules would otherwise be a plain statement, when we get to this part of the agreement that we're calling part two of his opinion, he's saying that's just different. You go to court. You have an independent alternative basis to go to court first.
We believe that is with respect to whether those claims that are brought are should be arbitrated. We don't believe that is correct with respect to the threshold issue. The arbitrator may decide is, no, that claim is for injunctive relief under this agreement. It should go to court. He could decide that. But we don't believe those exceptions go to the initial issue of who decides whether they should be arbitrated or not.
Well, then what happens to that language I just read you in Hansen, where that's what Justice Breyer seems to say, that a court can still decide whether a particular issue is going to be arbitrated, notwithstanding an otherwise binding agreement?
Well, as far as the general rule is, the court decides that issue unless the intent is clear and unmistakable that the arbitrator should do it. So we agree that if there wasn't an incorporation of the AAA rules, and this agreement, this arbitration clause says exactly what it says, but didn't incorporate the AAA rules, the court should decide that. We couldn't force them to say the arbitrator should decide whether these claims should be arbitrated. What Justice Breyer did is he just talked about the general rule there, and the clear general rule is the court decides. However, since arbitration is a matter of contract, if the parties intended to arbitrate the issue of who decides what claims should be arbitrated, that intent controls, but we want it to be clear and unmistakable. And our position is when you incorporate the AAA rules, which clearly provide that the arbitrator has that power, and I think it's very important in this case to say is we don't have to decide the broad general rule of whether that is the correct rule of law in all cases. We have two very sophisticated parties. The party opposing the arbitrator deciding whether the claim should be arbitrated is Willie Gary, LLC, which is the lead member, Willie Gary, a very well-respected attorney. This was a negotiated agreement, not a pre-printed form, between sophisticated parties. They said, we're incorporating by reference the AAA rules. That meant is they're going to live by them for all purposes.
Let me interrupt for a second. Let's assume that you're right on the arbitrability question, that the arbitrator, given the language in your contract, that the arbitrator should decide arbitrability. Does that really get you anywhere here? Because the arbitrator, presumably, is going to look at the contract and say, oh, dissolution. Dissolution is decided by the court. Now I'm going to send it back to the court to deal with a dissolution, since that's part of what's being raised here. So to some extent, are you asking us to say, Court of Chancery, you got it wrong. The arbitrator should have decided arbitrability under this wealth of law around the country. However, once we get to part two, we'll everybody will see, the arbitrator will see, that it comes back to the court. So we're back where we started from.
Right. Well, we think it's an important threshold issue of jurisdiction, first of all, of who decides. And if the arbitrator should decide it, that's jurisdictional. We respectfully disagree that an arbitrator would find that, as far as the dissolution claim, for example, that it should not be arbitrated. Because we believe, like the Terex Court said, saying judicial dissolution is not inconsistent at all with arbitration.
You're suggesting that when it goes back to the arbitrator, if it did, if we followed what Justice Berger suggested, that the arbitrator would ultimately conclude that dissolution's a decision for him or her to make and rule on it one way or another.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you want to save your balance for a rebuttal?
If I could.
Sure.
May it please the court, my name is Francis Pledgey. I represent Willie Gary LLC, and I'd like to join with my learned colleague from Texas in thanking the court for expediting the briefing and the oral argument in light of your busy docket. We appreciate it very much. I'd like to begin, if I can, with a brief factual context of why the issues, as important as they are, require more urgent attention than would otherwise be the case. This is in an affidavit attached to our Second Amendment complaint, which is part of the appendix. My client has invested about $40 million of his own money in this Black Family Channel cable TV station. And in addition to that, it requires him to invest from his personal assets about $800,000 a month to keep the doors open, to keep the lights on, and to keep the operations going. And at this point, he's either unwilling or unable to continue to finance those operations. And the other member of the LLC, James and Jackson, hasn't contributed any funds for its 20% interest in the company and has not contributed any funds for the continuing ongoing operations. And because we have not been able to reach a business solution to the problem, that's why we're trying to seek a judicial resolution. I'd like to also emphasize, if I may, all the things that the parties agree on. I think it's fair to say that the parties agree on what the applicable law is. And there are no factual disputes that would impact on the decision. So this
With regard to the applicable law, let's assume that we think the Court of Chancery should have followed the majority rule. It seems that the second part of the opinion is an independent alternative basis for concluding, even if the Vice Chancellor had followed the majority rule, he would still have decided this was a matter for the court. Is that the way you read his opinion?
That's the way I read it, Your Honor. I think that they're both independent analyses, that separate and apart from the issue of who should decide arbitrability, even if, and this may be a follow-up to one of Justice Berger's questions, even if this case were before an arbitrator, the arbitrator could decide that the issues that we have in our Second Amendment complaint of dissolution and specific performance are not covered within the arbitration clause. I'm not sure if that's responsive to your question, but...
Well, I look at it differently. I don't think you would have had to go to the arbitrator. And the quote I've read now twice seems to say that it's up to the court to decide whether a particular type of controversy is to be decided by a court, not the arbitrator. So it appears that you could have an agreement that would generally submit things to arbitration, but in the way it was written specifically, clearly state some matters, some controversies won't go there. And the way I read the second half of this opinion, Vice Chancellor Strine said, this is the type of controversy that would not go to arbitration.
I would agree with you. If we use the dissolution issue in particular as an example to respond to your question, the trial court specifically interpreted the agreement to require dissolution claims to be decided by the court. So if I understand Your Honor's question, the dissolution claim by the specific language of the agreement is not, and I think the, and I know the word that the Vice Chancellor used was impossible. He said it is impossible to interpret this agreement to require dissolution claims to be decided by an arbitrator.
So he
would
be
a pretty strong word.
He would say that not even the arbitrator, had the arbitrator in the first instance been the one to decide what was subject to arbitration, that it would be, to use what you say is his word, impossible for the arbitrator to conclude that dissolution was one of the options that he could arbitrate.
Your Honor, that's the way I read the opinion. The way I read the Vice Chancellor's opinion, that's a pretty strong word, that it's impossible to read the agreement to require a dissolution claim to be arbitrated.
In your view, what in the agreement is the source of that conclusion that makes that conclusion a logical one?
I think there are at least two. One is the general contract principle of the specific term of an agreement prevailing over a general term. And under Section 11.1A of the LLC agreement, the party specifically referred to a judicial determination of, and then it continues with language, it's very similar to Section 802 of the dissolution statute, the LLC dissolution provision. And so it specifically calls for a court to make a decision applying a specific standard to a specific set of facts, which I think is distinguishable from the language in the Turek's opinion. But to continue the answer, Your Honor, in that same Section 11, admittedly a different paragraph, but the same Section 11 of the LLC agreement that talks about dissolution, there's a reference in two other instances of a court of competent jurisdiction making a decision about judicial dissolution. So there are at least three specific references in the section of the agreement dealing with dissolution that express an intent of the parties that a court of competent jurisdiction, and in the other case, a judicial determination, which I think has to mean a judge, makes a decision about dissolution. And I think the court also used that analysis in connection with Section 12.12, which talks about the party seeking equitable, I think the word is injunctive, seeking injunctive relief, which we know is equitable relief, from any court of the United States. Any court of the United States could give the parties, or the parties could seek equitable relief. And the court used those clauses together and put them together and decided that was an expression of the intent of the parties that, at least in these instances, a court would be the applicable form. And I think that it's also historically been a form of equitable relief. Dissolution has been described as a form of equitable relief. So the parties specifically in the agreement provide for going to a court for equitable relief, and dissolution, in addition to being specifically referred to, is a form of equitable relief.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that you're correct in your interpretation of the party's intent in regard to dissolution, their intent that it be subject to judicial review or judicial action or the jurisdiction of it, any court in the United States that's appropriate. If we were to leave the opinion as it currently is alone as to the first issue, which is who makes the initial judgment about what's subject to arbitration, I can't say arbitrability, so I'll just say subject to arbitration. If we leave that opinion alone without comment, does that mean it becomes Delaware law that we are firmly in the minority camp in that respect?
Well, Your Honor, unless and until this court decides differently, I think that would be the only specific case I'm aware of on point.
Well, that's really my question. Is there any other language, holding or dicta, in any other Delaware case, Court of Chancery or the Supreme Court, that suggests we follow the majority view, which is to let the parties decide specifically who determines what subject to arbitrability?
I'm not aware, Your Honor, of any other case that would be responsive to your question that specifically addresses the issue.
Okay.
Specifically, head-on, addresses the issue. And if Your Honor wants me to address the issue of whether or not we would be in the minority if that were that opinion were to stand, I'd be happy to address that, too. I'm not sure if that was part of your question.
Depends on whether it's of interest to you.
Well, I'm only interested today in what is of interest to the court. But
I understood your answer to my question, though, we could conclude that we should follow the majority view. And notwithstanding that, look at this particular contract and say, even though you said all controversies are subject to arbitration, and we look at the agreement, and it says the arbitrator decides arbitration. As we keep reading the agreement, it appears there's an express exception for certain things that require a judicial determination, and that you're saying this is one of them. So we have a general statement that appears to be a plain statement, but when we look at the rest of the agreement, we have a specific carve-out.
That's the way I read it, Your Honor. So if I understand your question, independent of the issue of who should decide arbitrability, if we separate that and compartmentalize it and simply analyze the issue of whether specific claims like dissolution are within the scope of the arbitration clause, I think there's specific language in the agreement that excludes that from the arbitration clause. And it's a different analysis because the presumptions are completely opposite.
But at least when we're talking about your interest today, assuming your interest is having your client's position prevail, you can prevail as long as we agree with the second half of the opinion, no matter what we do with the first part.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I think that, and to be honest with you, I'd never analyzed it that way. But if we prevail on the second issue about whether our specific claims, such as dissolution, are within the scope of the arbitration clause, then in some ways the first issue could be moot, perhaps. Moot might not be the right word, but we would probably still get to the end point where we were trying to go.
But you do agree that if we didn't address the first point and left the opinion alone as to the first issue, Delaware would be in the minority.
Your Honor, I think that it would be in the minority in terms of total reported cases that my learned colleagues have done a great job of cataloging. But I don't know if there's been a specific case on point in every one of the 50 states. So I think it would be fair to say among the reported decisions that are on point that we are aware of.
Well, it's a federal statute, and the majority of the federal circuits
is.
That have addressed it,
it
have
is.
Come to a different conclusion than Vice Chancellor Strine.
Your Honor, that's an excellent point, and I think the important focus here is that this whole case is going to be decided on Delaware contract law, the state law of Delaware on contract interpretation. The federal courts are not binding on Delaware in terms of what is state contract law. I don't think there's any issue. I know there is no issue in this case that the policy of the state of Delaware is consistent with the Federal Arbitration Act. So this is not an area where there's a supremacy clause issue or whether state law is in conflict with federal law. This court has the final say on what is Delaware contract law. And to address the possibility that among the reported cases, whether, and I don't think we have reported cases in all 50 states that are specifically on point on this issue, but hypothetically, if Delaware were in the minority, I think Delaware is perfectly within its rights to decide on matters of Delaware contract law what this court decides is the best policy. And if I can use a quick example, the business judgment rule is a matter of Delaware state law. Hypothetically, if all the United States courts for each of the federal districts and most of the other states decided that the business judgment rule was a bad idea, was not good policy, and they didn't follow it, I think this court would certainly be within its rights to continue to say we may be in a minority, but it's a matter of state law, and we think as a matter of policy and law in Delaware, the business judgment rule is a good idea.
Well, that may or may not be an analogy. I'm focused on the fact that at least the Vice Chancellor believed that there was a federal statute that discussed arbitration that it applied in this instance because, like every breath of air we take, it somehow implicates the Commerce Clause. Therefore, we have to at least look to federal law.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. We should look to federal law, but I think federal law specifically in this instance looks to the state law of each individual state and the contract law of that individual state to make a final decision on contract interpretation. The only thing we need to do, based on the first options decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, which was adopted by this court in an opinion by Justice Holland and DMS Properties, the only thing the federal law in this context requires is that we use state law and apply state contract law within the framework of what first options refer to as a clear and unmistakable evidence. If we're talking about, for example, the first issue of who decides arbitrability, It's a state law issue, and the only thing we have to do is apply state law within the context of what is clear and unmistakable evidence in light of the contract. And that's true also for the second issue, whether or not a claim is within the scope of arbitrability, within the scope of the arbitration clause. It's also a matter of state law. So, yes, we look to federal law as so we can't ignore it, but since it's a matter of state contract law, I think this court is certainly within its bounds to decide what it thinks is the best law for the state of Delaware without being bound by either federal court's determinations of state law or other state courts. And there are state courts, like the Supreme Court of South Dakota has decided that it will not follow the federal decisions that decide that incorporation of the American arbitration rules by reference is an example of clear and unmistakable. So there certainly are courts out there. I can't deny that based on the cases I'm aware of, Delaware would be in the minority. But there are respected courts out there who have made well-reasoned decisions within the minority view.
Well, now that you bring that up, let me ask you that very question. Incorporating the American arbitration rules by reference, understanding that we have very sophisticated parties here who presumptively read those rules and had a good understanding of the implications of them for purposes of determining what disputes might be subject to arbitration and what would not, why isn't the language of the American Arbitration Association rules clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties intended these disputes to be subject to arbitration?
There are at least two good reasons, Your Honor. The first is the...
I knew you were ready for that.
Thank you, Your Honor. I hope after I'm done you'll feel the same way. But the rule that we're talking about, the AAA Rule 7A, doesn't require the arbitrator to make a decision on arbitrability. The rule is in the appendix, but to paraphrase it, it says that the arbitrator shall have the power to decide. It doesn't say the arbitrator shall and must, and only the arbitrator can decide issues of arbitrability. It's a permissive rule. So if the parties, as Vice Chancellor Strine said, really wanted the arbitrator and only the arbitrator to decide matters of arbitrability, they could have said that. And if the AAA rule said that an arbitrator must and always and only the arbitrator can decide arbitrability, then I don't think I could make a candid argument. But because the reference to the AAA rule does not specifically say the arbitrator must decide, that's not a clear and unmistakable expression of intent that only the arbitrator can decide. And the other reason is because the general contract rule of specific prevailing over general should apply here. We have specific instances where the parties in specific parts of the agreement said that the courts should decide issues such as dissolution. And I know that there's a danger of mixing the two arguments because I know that the analysis of who decides arbitrability is different from the analysis of what claims are within the scope of an arbitration clause, but I think the principle that you have to view the entire contract as a whole applies here. And if there are several references throughout the contract where the parties wanted the courts to decide certain things, that can be used as part of the analysis of what the expression of intent of the parties was. And if the parties really wanted the arbitrator and only the arbitrator to decide, then they could have specifically said that. And if the AAA rules specifically said that only the arbitrator and nobody else but the arbitrator can decide arbitrability, then I would not be able to answer your question, Your Honor, in the same way. But that's not what the AAA rule says. I see I have less than 2 minutes left, so I'd like to summarize if there aren't any other questions. I think we covered most of the arguments that I wanted to make. I think I might just make a few comments about the Terex case, if I may, about distinguishing it. I think that the language in the Terex case, the actual LLC agreement that the court interpreted in Terex, was different in at least two material respects. The first one is there's no specific language in the Terex agreement that specifically refers to the parties wanting or allowing a court to grant certain relief. The agreement does refer to injunctive relief, but Rule 43A, I believe, is the rule of the AAA that allows an arbitrator to grant injunctive relief. So simply because an agreement provides that the parties agree that injunctive relief would be appropriate doesn't mean necessarily that only the courts can grant that injunctive relief. The AAA is empowered by its rules to grant injunctive relief. So that's one important distinction. The other important distinction in the TARX agreement is that even though they do not, apart from not using the word court, the language about the dissolution clause, I think, is materially different. If you look at the whole entire phrase, judicial determination of whether it's practicable to continue on business is much different than the simple entry of a decree. And based on those reasons, Your Honor, I think that it's easy to distinguish the cases. So in sum, we believe that the trial court's opinion is very well reasoned, consistent with applicable law, and we respectfully request that this honorable court affirm the trial court for the reasons stated in the Vice Chancellor's opinion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Holland has raised a very important issue several times about can you affirm Vice Chancellor Strine's decision even if you disagree with him on the first issue of who decides arbitrability. We don't think so. If we are right on the first issue that the arbitrator should decide whether the claim should be arbitrated under this operating agreement, Section 1212 says all claims arising out of or related to this agreement should be arbitrated. You agree with us that the parties clearly and unmistakably made their intent clear by incorporating the AAA rules that the arbitrator should decide that. That's the end of the story. We don't go to the issue of, well, should these claims be arbitrated that are presented here? That's for the arbitrator. Even if a court thought, well, it's absolutely clear no reasonable man could disagree or person, excuse me, no reasonable person could disagree with me that the dissolution claim, for example, needs to be before me instead of an arbitrator. No, that's usurping the power of the arbitrator.
And that's where Mr. Pelleggi goes back to his distinction between general and specific. They seem to say all controversies, and then they go on to give a specific example of something that would start with a court. How do we reconcile that?
Okay. In our arbitration clause, we do have an exception for injunctive relief, and I think it's very important for the court to realize is it's an exception for injunctive relief, not for equitable relief. So the court can grant injunctive relief and specifically perform. A dissolution is not injunctive relief.
No, but I'm talking about the language later in the agreement that talks about as decided by the court. It seems, according to the Vice Chancellor, you had a choice. You could either start in court or start with the arbitrator, and there was language in the agreement that seemed to suggest you could start in court.
As to the judicial dissolution, we disagree with that because that reads out the arbitration clause. Assuming you go with my client and say, yes, they made their intent clear and unmistakable that the issue of whether claims need to be arbitrated go to the arbitrator, you don't go to Section 15. You go right to the arbitration clause. You look at the claims. You don't even get to Section 15, although an agreement should be read as a whole. What the arbitrator may say is, you know, Mr. Gary is right. Willie Gary LLC is right. It says judicial determination of dissolution. I think that's for the court. The arbitrator may decide that. The arbitrator may agree with us and say, no, that's not right, because I look at the TARX decision, I look at the decisions from other jurisdictions with dissolution, I talk about a judicial decree to dissolution, judicial determination, and there's nothing inconsistent with arbitrating the facts and the law, the arbitrator making an award, and then if you want, bringing it to the court to implement it, to enforce it, to vacate it, to remand it, to affirm it. Also important here, there's no dispute that we're under the Federal Arbitration Act. Once we get past the issue of who decides the claims, if you disagree with us on that, there is a presumption that the actual claim should be arbitrated since we have an arbitration clause. Not irrebuttable, but the benefit of the doubt goes to it should be arbitrated. Where is the evidence on the other side that it shouldn't be? They refer to the word judicial determination. Well, we disagree with that, just as the TARX court said, there's nothing inconsistent. So applying the presumption that claims should be arbitrated, the dissolution claim should be also arbitrated. They do have a claim, yes, for injunctive relief to specifically enforce us to delude us under our agreement. That's a claim that arises under or related to the agreement. What Vice Chancellor Strang found was, well, this is really a first to file kind of clause, what we have here. If you beat them to the punch and go to litigation, you don't have to arbitrate. We don't believe that gives proper respect under the Federal Arbitration Act, the arbitration clause. If a claim arises out of or related thereto, other than agreement, it should be arbitrated. However, if you need injunctive relief on an expedited basis, maybe you can go to the court and try to get that. But we believe the threshold issue is we don't even get to whether the claim should be arbitrated or not. We're here because the arbitrator should decide that issue under Supreme Court precedent. This clause was clearly unmistakably evidenced the party's intent by incorporating the AAA rules. So therefore, we request respectfully that you reverse the decision of the trial court. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, counsel. I want to ask you one question, even though I recognize time has expired. I ask both sides the same question. You thanked us for the fact that this is expedited, and, of course, we're happy to expedite it. But I'd like some sense of the date by which you anticipated an expedited decision.
We would not be presumptuous and have no expectation. What Vice Chancellor Strine said is, I'm going to have expedited discovery in this proceeding. James and Jackson LLC, I want you to agree that you're not going to arbitrate anything. You're not going to go to the arbitrator during this process. We agreed to that, of course. Then he said, we're going to have expedited discovery. It'll close on May 1. Therefore, we'll be ready to go either way, depending on what the Supreme Court does. So we had no expectation. We assumed it would be quick, but otherwise we're litigating the case.
Well, I don't anticipate either of you to be shy about this. I want a practical, what is the date by which you would like to see an opinion in order to maximize the efficiency of the future process?
I guess we'd
give
like
us your wish date. Other than by 5 o'clock today.
My wish date, Your Honor, would be the next date that payroll is due for the company that my client would have to pay about $250,000 out of his own pocket is March 15th. So that's the next date that my client has to decide whether he's going to continue to fund payroll or going to decide not to put any more money into the company. So I don't know if you're asking me for a wish date. I want to join and say I'm not presumptuous enough to suggest when the court should decide. But if the court's asking for a wish date,
yeah, I'm not sure that the court is. I am.
Well, Your Honor, if you're asking for a wish date,
if that bruise on the side of my leg is any indication, I probably shouldn't have asked. But
that would be a wish date. And I think that April 1st is the discovery cutoff date.
Oh, I'm sorry. Apologies. It is April 1st.
So our discovery in this case has to be done by
April 1st. Are you telling us that your client's going to walk away on March the 15th? I don't quite understand your answer. It seems to me the only debate is whether this is going to be arbitrated or whether it's going to be litigated. But you, in your answer, Mr. Pelleggi, seem to be suggesting maybe your client's just going to throw his hands up while everybody's figuring this out.
Well, Your Honor, again, that was a wish date. And I'm not suggesting it was scientific or mathematically precise.
Well,
I think that will help us.
Is he going to throw his hands up, and is this going to be a moot exercise because someone's going to file for bankruptcy?
Your Honor, it will not be moot, but depending on the court's decision, if the trial court retains jurisdiction to oversee our claims for dissolution, for example, we already have a schedule in place. We know that will be done expeditiously.
Well,
if it's gone to arbitration, then
let me be more direct than I was in December, because we did win a case in December, and we decided the case, and the opinion I don't think was even cool before everybody filed for bankruptcy. So you know, if we'd have known that, it probably would have been helpful. So is that really something that's imminent, or do you really just want to know where you're going to litigate this?
I think, Your Honor, the real question is where we're going to litigate this, and we don't have any. I'm not aware of any plans my client has for filing for bankruptcy. It's just that's the next deadline that my client has to put more money into the company. I'm not suggesting that he's not going to put more money into the company, but I agree there's some arbitrariness in picking that date, but I was hesitant to pick a date at all, but I had to accept the invitation.
Well, I think from Justice Holland's comment, you understand why we want to be practically helpful to the parties as best we can. That's why we expedited it in the first place. So the second issue is, in what way can we be most helpful? And if there is a, for lack of a better term, drop-dead date, we'd like to know what it is, because we don't want to rush off and do something quickly only to find out that expediting the effort really accomplished nothing. So I think we have a good sense of what you have in mind, and I appreciate you answering our question. With that in mind, we'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Thank you.